I am quite sure that you will all agree with me when I say that it is quite impossible to compress into one sermon, even one of the lengthier Sandyford sermons, the story of David. There are certain things that just cannot be done. And yet at the same time, it needs the whole of David's life to demonstrate his faith. Just as in exactly the same way, it needs the whole of our life, not a part of it, but the whole of our life, right to the very moment when we take that last final step into the glory that is eternal. It takes the whole of our life to learn faith and to show or demonstrate faith in our lives. Now, in one sense, I think it will be true to say that by the grace of God, faith is a once for all thing. By the grace of God, through the working of His eternal Spirit, by the instrumentality of the truth of the word of the gospel, we are brought to an awareness of things that are spiritual and eternal, an awareness of our need, an awareness of the answer to that need in Jesus Christ. And by that same grace, we are brought to the point or the place of commitment, and it is done. How I love the line of that hymn we sometimes sing. 'Tis done, the great transaction's done. I am my Lord's, and He is mine. And in a very real sense, faith is that kind of once-for-all thing. And yet at the same time, we will err very greatly if we do not realize that faith is something that must grow. It must develop, and it must mature. And it does these things. It grows and it develops and it matures and consequently becomes more honoring to God as life's experiences demand faith. Do you see what I mean? We can all look back, as we've indicated in our prayers tonight, to all the goodness of God in the past. And we have learned, in a sense, in the past to have faith in God. But you see, my friend, the faith of the past, just like the manna of yesterday, is no use for the experiences of tomorrow. You may feel that your faith has been sorely tried in this past week. Let me tell you, it will be more sorely tried this coming week, and the next week, and the next month, and the next year. Because this is how faith grows and develops and matures, as life's experience demands faith. And as God's providence orders things in our lives so that we have no option but to stand by faith. It's a very dangerous thing, you know, to speak to God in prayer. And sometimes in our more excitable moments, we're apt to breathe out very passionately and pray, "Oh God, increase our faith." Now watch it when you pray that, because God will love that prayer, and He will believe that you mean it, and He will proceed in His providence to take away from you all the other things that you might be tempted to lean upon or have confidence in, so that he will compel your faith to increase simply by taking away all the other props to life. And God orders our life in this way in His providence, so that we have nothing left to hold on to, and the only alternatives are faith or sink. That's how you learn faith. Now you see, faith is not static. And faith must develop to meet the increased demands that life brings. Now when we speak like this, we begin to realize that faith is not easy. I'm sure a great many people here in church tonight at this moment are saying, "Brother, you're quite right. Faith is not easy." The Bible never pretends that faith is easy. The Bible constantly speaks about faith in terms of the fight of faith. Now, what is the fight of faith? The fight of faith is essentially a fight to believe. A fight to believe and a fight to trust yourself to God when everything else inside you and outside you clamors for you to do otherwise. Now you see, this is something that David knew a great deal about. Poor David at times, he was a mighty man of faith, but poor David at times found himself almost torn asunder. When there were these powers and pressures that would take him in that direction, and others that would take him in that direction, his circumstances seemed to be absolute turmoil, and inwardly in his own spirit it seemed to be something like a volcano that was about to erupt. And you see, this was a man, David was a man, who had to fight and fight and fight and fight to trust himself to God when everything else in his circumstances and in his personality was clamoring for him to do otherwise. Now obviously David is a man from whom we can learn a great deal about faith. And one of the things that we do learn very clearly from David is that faith is never perfect. There were very many occasions in his life when David acted in unbelief. And when he acted in unbelief, he inevitably led himself and his work and all the people associated with him in that work into terrible complications. And in these terrible complications, David usually found himself having been led far away from God. And yet, in due time, David's heart swung back to its true direction. In the Authorized Version rendering of Psalm number 57, verse 7, you find David saying, "Oh God, my heart is fixed." The RSV has it, "I think my heart is steadfast." I think the old renderings, the truer to the spirit and to the emotion of the thing. "Oh God, my heart is fixed." And because his heart was fixed in God, No matter how far his life swayed, no matter how the complications of his unbelief put pressure upon him, and with mighty power, and unbelief has mighty power, with mighty power drew him away from God. This fact could never be contradicted. His heart was fixed in God, and in the end, the great and mighty love of the Redeemer's heart brought him back. And brought him back with the kind of potency that made him pray the prayers that we found in Psalm 32 and Psalm 51. "My heart is fixed. My heart is fixed." Now, if we want to see David's faith, we have to look at his life. And there is a tremendous realism in all the story of David, and I'm not expecting you to turn up all the references that I give you tonight. There is a tremendous realism in the faith of David, which is rather wonderfully expressed in two verses from the long psalm, and I don't think you need to turn them up. They're verses 67 and 71, where the psalmist here says, it doesn't say that it's a psalm of David, but where the psalmist says, "Before I was afflicted, I went astray. But now I keep thy word. It is good for me that I was afflicted, that I might learn thy statutes." To which statement David would have said, "Amen and amen." Now here is a man of faith. And I think we can see his faith, without going into too much detail of the story, I think we can see his faith in certain very clear aspects of his life. And I think we see David's faith, first of all, in the word submission. Now we often think of faith as a crusading thing, as a very virile and dynamic thing, and I wouldn't deny that for a moment. But David's faith is seen in the spirit of submission that was one of the essential marks of his life. Turn back, if you care to follow it, in the story in the Old Testament to the first book of Samuel, chapter 16, where David's story starts. The first book of Samuel, chapter 16, at verse 11. Samuel said to Jesse, "Are all your sons here?" And he said, "There remains yet the youngest, David by name, but behold, he is keeping the sheep." And Samuel said to Jesse, "Send and fetch him, for we will not sit down till he comes." And he sent and brought him in. Now David was ruddy and had beautiful eyes and was handsome, and the Lord said to Samuel, "Arise, anoint him, for this is the chosen one." Then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers. And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon David from that day forward, and Samuel rose up and went to Ramah. Now the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord tormented him. Now, here is the beginning of David's story. Called and anointed of God to be God's king, to be God's servant. What happened next? Look down to verse 19. Saul sent messengers to Jesse and said, "Send me David, your son, who is with the sheep." Well, there's a queer business, surely. The great prophet of God sent at the command of God to find the appointed king of Israel. That one is found, David, the anointed of the Lord. The oil in symbol of the Holy Spirit is put upon him, and as the scripture says, the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon David from that day. And what happened? He went back to his job as a shepherd. Occasionally, from that shepherd place, that's the succeeding verses after verse 19, David was called from the fields, from the lonely desert places where he was keeping the sheep. He was called to the court of Saul, and back again he went to keep the sheep, and back he was to the court of Saul, and back he was to keeping the sheep. Look down to 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 15, David went back and forth from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. What a come down. I suppose a very poor illustration would be graduating with first class honors, and then having to take a succession of temporary jobs, pen pushing in some grubby little office with the dullest of routine work. Where were all David's hopes? Where were all his aspirations? We read earlier on, the Spirit of the Lord came upon David. Where was all the bounding thrill and anticipation and eagerness of his heart? In submission before God. And if you read these chapters carefully, and we can't do that tonight, I've been looking at them, you will find that there was no resentment at all in David. Because you see, although he was not aware of the fact, he was being trained to be the shepherd of Israel. God had laid his hand upon him. He was anointed of God. The Spirit of God had come mightily upon him. But the time was not yet. And this man's faith, as early as this, was content to wait upon God. Look down to chapter 18 of Samuel at verse 6. As they were coming home, when David returned from war, from slaying the Philistines, the woman came out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul, with timbrels, with songs of joy, instruments of music, and the woman sang one to another as they made merry, "Saul has slain his thousands, the king has slain his thousands, and David has slain his 10,000." And you can imagine the cheer that went up for David. And you can't be surprised that in verse 8 you read, "And Saul was very angry, and this saying displeased him." Verse 9, "And Saul eyed David from that day on." And we were told earlier on, were we not, that a spirit of evil was troubling Saul the king. Do you see what is happening here, my friends? These stupid enthusiasts, and there are a great many stupid enthusiasts, they're never happy unless they're shouting. Oh, they think they're doing so marvelously. Half the time they only cause trouble. Like some of these little groups of gormless, carnal, unthinking students who have a long summer holiday and think, "Oh, now what can we do? Oh, we feel the Lord sending us to here, there, and everywhere." And off they go there. They break all the rules of the land. They create all sorts of complications. They make the situation for the resident missionaries almost untenable. But having created the most tremendous furore, their holiday's over, and back home they come. They forget about all that. The fact that the missionaries are now under police suspicion, the fact that restrictions are now put upon the missionaries, that doesn't matter at all. They were led of God to go. They weren't led of God at all, as these people here weren't led of God. The proof of the pudding, my friends, is the eating. And this tremendous surge of enthusiasm here, this verbal, this vocal enthusiasm brought the young man David, God's man of faith, waiting in submission for God's time. This foolish demonstration brought this man of God, whose work was still in the future, out into the open as a public figure, and brought him into direct confrontation with the enemy, this demon-possessed king whose name was Saul. And remember, we are told in the story of one occasion when David was playing his music to soothe the troubled mind of Saul, this dark, diabolical king whose hatred and jealousy for David had been stirred by stupidity, picked up his javelin and threw at it, and nearly killed The man who was called of God for years and years of mighty work in the future. And from this point onward, you read these stories. They don't take long to read through. They're far too exciting to linger over. From this point onwards, David was under the most tremendous devilish pressure and attack from Saul. He was driven into exile. He had to run for his life. He was hunted like an animal in the mountains. He hid in the very backmost recesses of caves, while this dark, diabolical creature tracked him with the one desire to do him to death. And all through this, David humbled himself in submission under the mighty hand of God. It was very clear that God was with him. David, I believe, already in his heart was aware of the fact, though perhaps not clearly, that he was destined not only for the throne but for glorious service. And because of this, because of his faith, he refused to be precipitated. It wasn't easy. You read your way through some of the Psalms with the help of a concordance, and you will find that it was being said publicly, and David knew about it. It was being said publicly, there is no help for the likes of him in God. This is what people said. He's a reject. I forget which of the Psalms. Is it Psalm 142? A brief psalm, if I remember rightly, where David... Oh, how my heart feels for him. Where David says, in anguish of costly loneliness, no man cared for my soul. And in a situation like that, his faith was manifest in his quiet submission. Turn over to 1 Samuel chapter 26 at verse 7 or verse 6. David said, "Who will go down with me into the camp of Saul?" And Abishai said, "I will go down with you." Chapter 26 verse 7. So David and Abishai went to the army by night, and there lay Saul sleeping within the encampment with his spear stuck in the ground at his head, and Abner and the army lay around him. Then said Abishai to David, "God has given your enemy into your hand this day. Now therefore let me pin him to the earth with one stroke of the spear. I will not need to strike him twice." But David said to Abishai, "Do not destroy him. Who can put forth his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless?" And David said, "As the Lord lives, the Lord will smite him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall go down into battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should put forth my hand against the Lord's anointed." It was as if David said, "Now look, God will deal with this in his own good time." Now look down to chapter 27 verse 1. Then David said in his heart, "I shall now perish one day by the hand of Saul." Well, you say, "Preacher, that's a contradiction." Yes, we spoke a few seconds ago about the quiet, assured submission of faith. And then suddenly, as it were, without any warning, there is a great surge within David. There is something takes possession of his mind, his heart, his emotions, and an absoluteness of panic. He said, "Oh, I'm finished. I'll perish by the hand of Saul. There's nothing better for me now that I should escape to the land of the Philistines." Here is the man of faith, you see. Remember, we've spoken already about the devil. Here is the man of faith, gripped by irrational fear. Now you see, as we are saying this morning, fear is always in conflict with faith. And David here, I don't know how it came about. I suppose there are psychological as well as spiritual reasons for it. He had been through a tremendous conflict. He had suffered over a long spell of time. He had very little reserve of energy. A tremendous battle had been won when he was tempted by the men nearest him to take precipitate action. And he had resisted in faith. What a triumph of faith. And then, in the moments immediately following the crisis, he was gripped by this irrational fear. As the story goes on to tell us, he is led not only into distress, but into terrible humiliation. This is the work of the devil. When David, God's man, had to play act in the front of the Philistine king, and he dribbled saliva down in his beard, and he went about in a grotesque sort of manner, feigning madness. That's what fear does. This is the work of the devil. And it was in a situation like this, or out of a situation like that, that David penned the psalm that we sang earlier in the service, Psalm 34. This poor man cried. You see, my heart is fixed. Can you imagine David after that clowning performance? Can you think of this big man, shamed, humiliated, dejected? Can you imagine him in his own quarters? Oh, the wretchedness. And almost irresistibly, his eyes and his heart were drawn to God. And this poor man cried. And God heard and delivered him out of all his distresses. Oh, my friends, what a God is the God of David. His heart swung back. And later on in his life, much later in his life, you haven't time to look this one up, in 2 Samuel chapter 16 at verse 5, in the context of the story of Absalom's rebellion, years and years afterwards, David came to Bahurim, and there came out a man of the family of the house of Saul whose name was Shimei. As he came out, David and his companions were journeying. As Shimei came out, he cursed continually, and he threw stones at David and at all the servants of the king. And the people and the mighty men were on his right hand and his left. And Shimei said as he cut, "Begone, begone, you man of blood, you worthless creature. The Lord has avenged upon you all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. The Lord has given the kingdom into the hand of your son Absalom. See, your ruin is on you." Everybody knows, David, you're a reject, you're cursed of God. And Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said, "Why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over and take off his head." But the king said, what have I to do with you? If he is cursing because the Lord has said to him, curse David, who then shall say, why have you done so? And David said to Abishai and to all his servants, behold, my own son seeks my life. How much more may this Benjamite? Let him alone. Let him curse. For the Lord has bidden him. It may be that the Lord will look upon my affliction, and that the Lord will repay me with good for this cursing of me today. He submitted. That's faith. Avenge not yourself. Give place to wrath. When you are reviled, revile not again. Commit yourself to the God who judges righteously. The submission of faith. We could, if we only had time, speak about the service of faith, and it wasn't my intention to speak of this. It's far too big a subject for such a sermon. But in Acts chapter 13, verse 22, you find testimony concerning David in these words. Listen to this. When God had removed Saul, he raised up David to be their king, of whom he testified and said, I have found in David, the son of Jesse, a man after my heart, who will do all my will. Now you see, my friends, this is the service of faith. To walk with God and do what you're told. And David's faith is seen in the submission of his heart that was fixed in God, in the service of his life in which he walked with God. But you know, most of all, and we've very little time to deal with this, most of all, David's faith is seen supremely in relation to his sins. And the story of David's great sin is a terrible story. And I believe with all my heart, I think I'm just learning this, that only a saint can sorrow over sin. We read Psalm number 32. Oh, the blessing. The man who is forgiven. Oh, said David, when I refused to confess my sin, God's hand was on me, and I was troubled, and I was restless. My whole being burned and dried up within me. And remember that David's great sin was not the sin of a novice. It was when David was far on. It was when he was established as king. It was when he was a great man, a man of spiritual reputation, that he sinned his terrible sin with Bathsheba. It was the sin of a man who had been tried of God and used of God. And when you read Psalm 32 and then you read Psalm 51, oh, they're terrible psalms to read. You begin to realize that this man of faith was a man who had looked right into the face of God and had seen holiness and love. He had seen, as he looked into the face of God, this man of faith who had sinned and whose sin was gripping his soul like a terrible vice. He looked into the face of God and saw not only holiness and love, he saw judgment and mercy. And you begin to understand why there was wrung out of this man's heart the confession against thee. Thee only have I sinned and done this evil in thy sight. And the scripture makes it clear that the greater part of David's sin was not in respect of Bathsheba, but in respect of Uriah, her husband. The greater part of David's sin, oh my friends, take heed, the greater part of David's sin was not the sudden kindling and outburst of passion. It was the deliberate, calculating, brazening out of what he had done before men and before God. The story as we close is in 2 Samuel chapter 11. Oh, what a story. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go forth to battle, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel. But David remained at Jerusalem. Have you heard people saying, Christian people I mean, saying in respect of Christian service, in respect of worship, in respect of going to the prayer meeting, in respect of reading their Bibles and praying at home, have you not heard Christian people saying, well, why do it if your heart's not in it? I'll tell you, it's safer. David's heart wasn't in this battle, and he sent his generals and his captains, and David tarried at Jerusalem. I keep on saying in my own heart about this, why did he do it? How did it come about? Well, it tells us here David remained at Jerusalem. He let others carry the burden of the work and the warfare. And he forgot that the enemy of his soul was lying in ambush. And in one casual moment of vision, mind you, the woman was to blame. And there are far too many women, by the things they do, by the way they dress, by the way they behave themselves, are making themselves nothing other than sources of temptation, and God will not hold them guiltless. David, in that one moment of casual vision and immediate stirring of emotional tension and desire, he being at that time in some sort of spiritual vacuum because of the neglect of his spiritual duties, in that one moment, with a swiftness that is absolutely frightening, the deed was done. And the deed being done, David's one concern was to cover up and hide from men what he had done. And he succeeded. But God knew, and God was displeased And it is now, I think, significantly in David's life that we begin to realize just how utterly he was God's man. 12 months went past before Nathan the prophet came to confront David. And in these 12 months, as we learned from Psalm number 32, God's hand was on David. When I declared not my sin, my body wasted away. Through my groaning all day long, day and night thy hand was heavy on me. My strength was dried up as by the heat of summer. There was no peace. There was the devouring passion of an evil and a guilty conscience. For 12 long months, God, by his eternal Spirit, wrestled with this man David within the solitary confinement of a bad conscience. And for 12 long months, David fought against conviction. For 12 months David repressed the remembrance of his sin. For 12 months David refused to submit to the verdict of God. For month after month after month, David refused to confess his sin. Spiritually, he was estranged from God. His heart wanted to be there, and he knew he couldn't go there. He was estranged from God. He was agonized by his guilt, and it was obvious to the people who knew him. Psychologically, he was restless and he was tormented. I think it would be true to say he was demented. Physically, he was worn down and worn down and worn down. And you know, my friends, it was because he was a saint that it hurt him so much. Godless men do this kind of thing day in, day out. They'll be at it tonight with their wives at home with the children. The wives not knowing where their men are, and there will be no guilty conscience. There will be no agonizing regret. If there is one thing that I thank God for amongst many, it is the potency of a bad conscience. And when a saint of God has done wrong and the conviction of God has fixed in the conscience like a barb, oh my friends, it is absolute agony. And this went on not only for weeks but for months, for 12 long months. And eventually Nathan the prophet came to David, and Nathan the prophet said, "Thou art the man." And I think in that moment, David gave an almighty sigh of relief. At last, it was out in the open. And he knew he could go back to God. You know that I would never breach the confidence of pastoral counseling. But years ago in that vestry through there, I stood speaking to a man. And I knew increasingly as we spoke, and we had spoken many times, what I had to say. And what I had to say to him was really what Nathan said to David. It is this. Isn't it? And with a sigh like David's, that man said, yes. For a long, long time, in the hell of a troubled conscience and a tormented spirit, this sin had tyrannized the whole of his life. Oh, he was a Christian man. Of that I have not the slightest doubt. Not a soul among all his close friends knew a single thing about this. It had been locked up in the caverns of his conscience. For how long, I don't really know, but it had been a long time, and it was in the process of destroying that fellow's life. Just as it was with David. And when the prophet came to David and said, thou art the man, David just said, oh, yes. And he knew that he could get back to God by getting rid of this sin in a great confession of his heart that we have in Psalm 51. Oh, I know for the rest of David's life the recoil and the repercussions of his sin mentally and emotionally tortured him. And I don't know sometimes that there's really release from that hangover, from this kind of sin. But there is pardon. And you can understand now, I'll close, I've gone on too long. You can understand why I said in Psalm 32 when we were reading it earlier on, that we shouldn't really just read, blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven. But rather, oh, the blessedness. Oh, my friends, do you know anything about this? The unloading of the heart in the presence of God and the assurance of pardon. Do you understand why we're going to sing in just a moment the great 23rd Psalm, the Shepherd Psalm? He restores my soul.